Good morning. The meeting will come to order. Welcome to the March 5th, 2025 meeting of the Budget and Finance Committee. I'm Supervisor Connie Chan, Chair of the Committee. I'm joined by Vice Chair Supervisor Matt Dorsey and Member Supervisor Joel Engardio. Our clerk is Brent Houtlipa. I would like to thank SFGov TV for broadcasting this meeting, particularly Jamie Etcheverry. And so with that, Mr. Clerk, do you have any announcements?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a friendly reminder to those in attendance to please make sure to silence all cell phones and electronic devices to prevent interruptions to our proceedings. Should you have any documents to be included as part of the file, they should be submitted to myself, the clerk. Public comment will be taken on each item on this agenda. When your item of interest comes up and public comment is called, please line up to speak on the west side of the chamber to your right, my left, along those curtains. And while not required to provide public comment, we do invite you to fill out a comment card and leave them on the tray by the television to your left by the doors if you wish to be accurately recorded for the minutes. Alternatively, you may submit public comment in writing in either of the following ways. Email them to myself, the Budget and Finance Committee Clerk, at brent.jalipa@sfgov.org. If you submit public comment via email, it will be forwarded to the supervisors and also included as part of the official file. You may also send your written comments via U.S. Postal Service to our office in City Hall at 1 Dr. Carlton B. Goodlett Place, Room 244, San Francisco, California, 94102. And finally, Madam Chair, items acted upon today are expected to appear on the Board of Supervisors' agenda of March 11th, unless otherwise stated. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Clerk. And before we start, as a reminder to everyone that typically when we have a budget and legislative analyst report, we will go to the city departments and then the BLA, and then we will have comments and questions from this committee, and then we go to public comment. And with that, Mr. Clerk, please call item number one.
Yes, item number one is a hearing on the first year free program, including a report on the number of small businesses supported since the program's inception, remaining obstacles to full implementation, and necessary steps to make the benefits to new small businesses permanent. Madam Chair.
Thank you, and we want to welcome Supervisor Steve Sherrill here, and really thank you so much for calling this hearing, and the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Chair Chan, Vice Chair Dorsey, Supervisor Engardio, for scheduling this hearing today. I'm deeply appreciative for the opportunity to be here. The subject of this hearing is the first year free program, which waives initial registration, license, permit, and other applicable fees for new small businesses and existing eligible shops that are opening a storefront. Now, this item was my first introduction at the board because I strongly believe that programs like this are an example of City Hall being a partner, not an obstacle, to the success of entrepreneurs and to the vibrancy of our city. Making it easier to open and thrive as a small business in San Francisco must be a shared priority for city leaders. Empty storefronts need to be filled. Creative, small business entrepreneurs must be empowered. I believe that today we will hear about the massive successes of First Year Free, but the reason we are here today is because First Year Free will sunset this July unless legislative action is taken to extend this program. Now, as is discussed weekly at this committee, the reality of our budget situation will call for hard decisions on what programs we prioritize to further our city's post-pandemic recovery. If we are to renew First Year Free, which I believe is, again, imperative to our success as a city, we must enable it to be as efficient and impactful as possible. I'm extremely grateful to my colleagues, Chair Chan, Vice Chair Dorsey, Supervisor Engardio, for weekly engaging on this incredibly difficult work here on the Budget Committee to reckon with our shortfall. I hope this hearing will offer us a forum to discuss the program's budgetary impacts and the challenges hindering smooth interdepartmental coordination and the opportunities to strengthen the program's effectiveness moving forward. I want to thank Office of Small Business Director Katie Tang and Amanda Freed from the Treasurer and Tax Collector, and call them to the podium to provide a quick presentation and engage in this critical discussion with us today. We really owe the success of this program to you and to your teams. Thank you very much for being here today.
Good Good morning. Thank you so much for having us. My name is Amanda Freed, Chief of Policy and Communications from the Treasurer's Office, and I'm joined here by Katie Tang, the Director of the Office of Small Business. Before we dive into the meat of these slides, I really just want to acknowledge that First Year Free is truly a multi-departmental labor of love. There are folks in departments across the city and customer service teams and accounting teams, city attorney's office, who really every day are working to make this program a success, and we could not do it without all of their help. So since the program began in November of 2021, we've seen 9,400 businesses enroll in First Year Free. And we've waived nearly $5 million since the inception of the business, and since the inception of the program. And you can see here a breakdown by department of which department fees have been waived through the program. First Year Free was first created as a one-year pilot program during the pandemic, and we've been really happy to see it extended several times. As Supervisor Cheryl mentioned, we are coming up on the end of the current extension, and so look forward to speaking with you all about that. The program waives the cost of the initial registration fees for businesses when they first register as a business, their permit fees in the first year, any application fees, and their initial license fees. And this is a program that works both for new businesses that are starting in San Francisco for the first time, but also for new locations of existing businesses. And to qualify, a business has to have $5 million or less in San Francisco gross receipts and have a registered location for commercial use. When we started First Year Free, we thought it was really important to create a program that didn't have an application, that was really automatic and seamless for businesses, that wouldn't give them sort of one extra step to take, but just be something that happened to them. So I'm going to walk you through a little bit of how we've made that happen. When a business registers with our office, and that's generally the first step that a business has to take when they're starting in San Francisco, they use a form called New Business Registration. And every business is probably somewhat familiar with this process. We ask you a bunch of questions, you know, who you are, what are you doing, so that we understand that and can properly assess you taxes, everyone's favorite activity in San Francisco. During this process, we also have embedded the questions for First Year Free. So we're automatically figuring out who might be eligible for this program. And once they register, they get a pop-up that says, you know, congratulations, it looks like you qualify for First Year Free, gives you some instructions, and then immediately after you're finished, you get an email from our office with more instructions and then a letter in the mail. What those instructions say are basically, hey, you know, you can take this letter with you when you go to any permitting agencies and let them know you're part of First Year Free. Even if you don't have the letter, the departments are able to look it up. We have a lookup system that all of the departments can share. And then you never should have to pay the fees in the first place. It is fully automatic. So you go to DBI and you're pulling a building permit. You tell them I'm part of First Year Free, and then when it's time to pay the fee, it is waived. That works the same in DPH, in planning, sort of across our city family. Similar process is if you're opening up a new location. So let's say you have a thriving business in one commercial corridor and you're opening up your second or your third and you still meet the qualifications for First Year Free. You just simply add that location to the information that the tax collector has about your business. And then the same thing, you're prompted with the First Year Free questions and you immediately get enrolled in the program. Here are the fees that have been waived by fiscal year and by department. As you can see here, the DBI fees are the most significant, followed by fees collected by the treasurer's office. These are both business registration fees, but also license fees that we collect on behalf of other departments. So this is a spread around as well. And happy to answer questions when we get into that portion, but wanted you all to have this sort of just broad overview of the program. And now I'm going to turn it over to Katie for the much more fun part of this presentation, which is talking about some of the success stories.
Right. Good morning, supervisors, and also want to thank Amanda and everyone at the Treasurer and Tax Collector's Office for their excellent management of this program. I will also start by saying that this program has been such a great marketing tool for businesses, whether new or those who want to expand, really sending the message to entrepreneurs that we are open for business in San Francisco. So has been truly valuable, especially when people are either starting out new or expanding and really don't have a whole lot of resources. They're trying to juggle rent, they're trying to buy equipment, they're trying to figure out how they're going to maybe even pay themselves or not pay themselves. And so when they get that surprise at the permit center and they don't have to end up paying any fees, it's really wonderful. And in fact, I've encountered business owners who said, you know, they opened up a new shop in San Francisco. They were going to initially expand in another jurisdiction. When they were faced with potentially $20,000 in permit fees alone in that other jurisdiction, they changed their mind and decided that they were going to go and expand in San Francisco. So we do see on a day-to-day basis that this has been a really great attraction tool. We have a couple of examples here on the slides before you of a few businesses that have benefited, and there's a whole range of how much and permit fees have been waived. So Casa Guadalupe on Cesar Chavez and the Mission, they saved about $1,800 in fees through the program. We've got Running Wilder and the Castro, and you know, again, basically expressing that any assistance that they received was so much appreciated. El Mil Amores, they actually opened up in the Mission and saved about $11,000 on their permit fees. Again, this is just permit fees alone. There's so many other costs to starting up a business. And in fact, Andrea is starting or expanding very soon in another location in the city. Same with Tala Wines, that had opened up in Excelsior. And moving on to Blue Truck Studio, they had about $2,500 in fees waived. And Cafe de Casa also had a first-year fee waived for one of their expansions to Fisherman's Wharf. And all the fees, the permit fees that are waived really depends on the scope of the work. So the more intensive the project, the tenant improvement, the more fees will be waived. And the less, then less permit fees will be charged. And then here are just a few additional examples that you can see here with SF Tykes Academy, actually, and Glazed Donuts, and Mama Hoo Hoo Restaurant, having been assessed some of the larger ones you could see on this list. So with that, I think Amanda and I are happy to answer any questions that you have. We know that as we're heading into the budget season, we have difficult decisions and trade-offs we have to make here. But we certainly, from at least Office Small Business, would love to see the first-year free program continued.
Thank you both very much for being here today and for your presentation. I've got a few questions, and my colleagues may as well. But first, I just want to, it was great to see some of the success stories there, but have we heard stories of entrepreneurs who are hesitant to open in San Francisco but kind of decided to do so upon learning about First Year Free?
Yes, I think it's both First Year Free as well as I would say, the wraparound services that we offer as a city. Many other cities don't have as robust of a, say, you know, Office of Small Business, so we're very proud of that, that can offer a whole range of services from leasing support to permitting help to helping people navigate local, state, or even federal forms that they have to fill out. So I think that on top of the permit fees being waived has really convinced a lot of people to open up or expand here in San Francisco. Doesn't mean that we don't have challenges that we still need to address. We certainly can always improve, but we do offer a whole lot of support.
Well, maybe topic of challenges, would you mind detailing some of the obstacles that small businesses are currently facing, either when attempting to utilize first-year free benefits or even just being aware of the program?
Yes. So I think as Amanda described, the Treasurer and Tax Collector's Office has tried to make it as easy as possible for people to enroll and to not even miss that step of getting into the first year free program. Certainly, we have many different departments and agencies. It's not always a small business owner that's pulling a permit. For example, it could be contractors, it could be architects, it could be permit consultants, lawyers even. And that business account number that is tied to the permit may not reflect that actual businesses. It might be, again, the architect, the contractor. And so sometimes that fee waiver might not be applied when it should have been. So in that case, we will ask for refunds to be processed. But that is one of the key things, as well as just the certainty of knowing that the program can continue.
That's interesting. You're talking about certain situations in which eligible businesses end up paying a fee. Do you mind walking us through the process for getting those fees reimbursed?
Yes. So if we find out that a business had paid for their permit fees when they really shouldn't have, then our office will initiate contact with that relevant agency. And we will say, hey, here's their business account number. They were eligible for first year free, which we can easily look up in the Treasurer and Tax Collector's website. And we will request the refund on behalf of the business and loop them in. So we just basically communicate with the different departments on that.
Great. You talked a little bit about the different departmental silos, and then this also has been in pilot since its inception. What have been some of the hurdles that the program has faced being a pilot instead of being a permanent or at least longer program?
Sure. And I'm happy to also have Amanda chime in as well. But I think from what we've seen is that when it's a pilot, some of the departments may not feel that it's necessary to invest in certain changes in technology or systems in order to more easily process these types of applications and making sure that the permit fees are waived. And so I think when it's renewed on a year-by-year basis, there's just that element of, well, we're just going to kind of keep things as is status quo, and there's no need to kind of improve on the process. So, and I see Amanda here. I'm sure she can speak to more.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I would add to that, I think that our department works directly with many of the permitting agencies to do their billing and collections. So for the departments that we have that sort of direct relationship with, we're already pretty linked technologically and have a lot of day-to-day contact. I think where we've had the most growth and opportunity is with DBI and planning, because we don't typically do their billing and collections, and so our systems are not necessarily as integrated. And we see the most opportunity there, as Katie said, the identification of a business when they're pulling a permit and that process to say, okay, this is the actual business who's going to benefit ultimately versus this is the individual or the entity that's pulling the permit isn't necessarily an important distinction for that agency, but for first year free, it does matter. And so I think figuring out a way to solve some of those issues will take some resources, and that hasn't been something that we've been able to prioritize during a pilot.
Is there a kind of return on investment if we invest up front on those resources to streamline the cross-departmental coordination, interdepartmental coordination? What would the long-term impact of that be on the budget?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to project exactly. I can say, you know, I think the board under the leadership of then Supervisor Chu, now City Attorney Chu, worked on a massive overhaul of license collection more than 10 years ago. I want to say it was like 14 years ago, to put DPH fire, police, entertainment on one single billing cycle that our department would bill and collect for. That was a big undertaking. It took a lot of time and effort to kind of legislatively fix all of the deadlines and the penalties and all of that work. We also sort of built a technology to allow the city to collect. I think we had some idea of how that was going to help the city, but we've seen that return, you know, way more than I think anybody might have projected, because we started to really understand how a business is interacting with the city as a whole. All of the different touch points that a particular location has, all the different inspections, the permits, the fees that they're paying. And ultimately, that investment is what helped during Prop M last year to identify that small businesses were being disproportionately harmed through license fees, and we were able, with many of your support, to eliminate $10 million in license fees for small businesses. I don't think that type of effort would have been possible without a unification, without a technology infrastructure behind it, and without some real legislative cleanup to align things. And so I think when we're talking about some of these incremental steps that could happen through First Year Free, I think we're hopeful that we would also then see some benefits more broadly, both for businesses and for the city.
Thank you. You know, you brought up Prop M and eliminating somewhere around $10 million in licensing fees for businesses. Do you mind talking a little bit about the overlap between Prop M and First Year Free, and kind of specifically, I guess my specific question would be, does Prop M alleviate the fiscal impact of the First Year Free program at all?
Yeah, the short answer is no. And I think, let me explain a little bit about how these programs overlap. So if you're a new restaurant and you're starting out, you know, your typical thing might register with our office. You'll get those business registration fees waived. Then your next step might be to go to DBI or planning, you know, do some work there, get those fees waived. Then you're going to apply at DPH for your health permit, and you won't pay an application fee. That'll be waived through First Year Free. Once that gets approved, then your first year of your license fee for that health license that's associated with that permit, that will be waived as part of First Year Free. When we look at the waivers in Prop M, only that very last piece, that first year of the annual health license, is getting waived through the Prop M waivers. And so there's an impact, but it's fairly modest. And generally, we see it as covering like the increases in CPI that many departments, you know, will see an increase in their fees year over year. And then the Prop M reductions kind of, they balance each other out. So it's a bit of a wash moving forward. A lot of the conversation when we were talking to businesses during Prop M was a real desire to help businesses that were already operating in San Francisco, and to really focus on like, okay, we're already here. How can you show us that we matter? And so that Prop M license is really focused on existing businesses, whereas First Year Free is alleviating the costs in that first year.
Thank you. Have there been, you know, talking about overlap and budget impacts, have there been any unexpected budget challenges or overruns associated with the program over the last few years?
I don't think anything unexpected. I think as departments change their fee structures, so we saw some increases last year for certain departments in their fee structure, and then of course that makes First Year Free more expensive. So, you know, it's not unexpected, it's just we can't necessarily plan for it until we see department budget submissions and what ultimately gets passed by the board.
Gotcha. And in terms of kind of planning for it, you know, we talk about, obviously, normally these fees would go to cover staff time and resources. Do we have a sense of how much staff time and resources are currently spent processing these applications, verifying ability, handling appeals, et cetera?
Yeah, I think in the treasurer's office, we have two positions that are funded for First Year Free. One is for our accounting team. They're the ones that are working with all of the departments to make sure that they get reimbursed from the First Year Free pot in the general fund for any fees that they've waived. And then we also have some customer service time, a supervisor in our customer service unit. I would say the the impact that we see, again, is accounting teams, fiscal teams throughout. They're the ones that are really submitting and kind of making sure that we're waiving appropriately for customers and then moving money from one spot to another spot every month. And then, you know, there is certainly some customer service impact, both in our department, the Office of Small Business, the Permit Center. You know, I think there's staff that are really working day in and day out with businesses to help them navigate generally through the city processes, and First Year Free is part of that. And there is also some annual work on, you know, upgrading the forms and making sure that the technology is working as well.
Got it. Do we yet have any projected kind of revenue generation as a result of First Year Free, whether it's increased sales tax revenue, other economic indicators at this point?
I think I would defer those questions to the controller's office generally to help understand.
Thank you. So we talked a little bit just now about some of the processes that go under there. As we look towards the future or a potential future, what are some ways that we can maybe streamline either the qualifications, the fee waivers, or other ways to look at decreasing the cost of the administration of the program?
I think in terms of the identification, the process generally works. I think there's, again, some work to do to really better link up the process of, do you have to register first with the Office of the Treasurer and Tax Collector, or can you pull a permit at DBI without doing that? So I think that's an area where, you know, we've been working and trying to figure out a better pathway so it's more clear for businesses. If they start and they pull a permit and they haven't registered, they're not qualified for First Year Free. And so I think that's an area that, you know, we want to keep looking at. We don't want to make things any more difficult for businesses, but we also, you know, want to make sure that we're kind of operating appropriately. I don't think there's a lot of administrative cost to this program. It's pretty well built into how we're doing business, and it's not really I don't think there's a significant administrative burden that we're trying to remove.
You talked previously, I mean, there are some, I hear you loud and clear on the low administrative costs generally, but you talked about some of the hurdles of, on the technology side, collecting the permits. How much time would that take if we look at these kind of one-year pilot cycles we've done? Is it a three-year pilot, a five-year pilot, permanence? What does it take in terms of renewing this program for you, for the city as a whole, to look at actually investing in a fully efficient, really streamlined process? Is that, you know, when you're looking at the extension of the program in the future, what does a perfect world look like there to make this program really run the way it should?
I mean, a perfect world is generally for us like a 10-year runway, you know, to say this program will be here for 10 years and then we can make the appropriate investments in technology. That generally for us seems to be the runway where, you know, after 10 years, whatever we do, we're going to have to upgrade anyway. But that would give us enough time to really work with our colleagues, invest in the technology, and the systems change. And I think it's really important. It's not just like throwing a new system out there, but it's really working together to reorient some of the processes that we have on all fronts and make sure that the flow for businesses makes sense and that they're getting what they need through it. So technology is one piece of it, but that would be, you know, I think that would be the perfect scenario. I think 5 years could work as well.
And extending it by a year, do we have an opportunity to invest in some of those program efficiencies if we only do a one-year extension?
I think in terms of all of the work going on to improve how the city is functioning for small businesses, we will continue. You know, we work together. I think I talk to Katie almost every day. I think we'll continue to work together very closely with our other agency partners as well, and we have many different touch points. So it's not as if we're not going to do anything if we don't get a longer runway for First Year Free, but there's an opportunity. I think we'll miss the opportunity to really change the infrastructure.
Yeah, thank you. And then my last question, and then I'll turn it over to my colleagues. Are there any specific best practices you've learned from First Year Free? And to either of you, this question can be directed, that would help us shape the next phase into a specifically more effective program. I know you've touched on a little bit here and there, but are there any key things where you said if we could really focus,
Yeah, and I'd welcome your point of view as well, Director Tang. But I think from our perspective, it was really important to figure out a process that would work at scale for businesses and that wouldn't rely on like word of mouth or communications, but that everyone would just sort of magically get. And over time, we've tweaked the definition of who qualifies for first year free to respond to where there was some friction. So, you know, I forget in our first year, but we had some, it was like only ground floor businesses, and then we were excluding some, and we spent a lot of time like kind of nitpicking with businesses whether or not they could qualify. And the board was very open in the next year to saying like, okay, let's broaden that definition. I think where we've landed now is it's pretty open-ended for businesses. It's you know, it's a revenue threshold. That's a data point that we collect for taxes, so we feel really good that they're giving us accurate information, and I think it's helped us really make sure that everybody who can possibly qualify does up front, except in some of those instances, as I've mentioned, where somebody is going before they've registered as a business, or as Director Tang mentioned, when they're somebody other than the business owner is the one pulling the permits. Those are kind of the two areas I think we still see from time to time.
Great. Well, thank you. I have no more questions, but as we've heard today, I think there are many successful examples of small businesses who've benefited greatly from this first-year program. And really giving these businesses a leg up. You know, I think we see in our small business corridors, in our incredibly diverse communities, in many of our immigrant communities, the challenges with opening up new storefronts are myriad, and helping them open, stay open, flourish is really critical during this time when our retail and restaurant sectors are still struggling to recover. So I really think it's pivotal that this hearing helped us understand how we can expand upon the investment, especially, you know, given the really critical fiscal situation of the city. And so Amanda Fried, Director Tang, thank you so much for being here to present on this item, and my colleagues on the Budget Committee and Chair Chan especially, thank you very much for hearing this item today. I look forward to continuing working with you to build on successes and continue to make San Francisco the best city in the world to open a small business. Thank you.
Thank you, Supervisor Sherrill. And with that, let's go to a public comment on this item. I don't see any name on the roster, and therefore, let's go to public comment on this item.
Yes, if we have any members of the public who wish to address this committee regarding this hearing, now is your opportunity. Madam Chair, we have no speakers.
Seeing no public comments, public comment is now closed. What is your will, Supervisor Sherrill? Would you like to continue this hearing, or would you like us to have this item heard and filed?
I'd love to have this item heard and filed.
Wonderful. Thank you, Supervisor. And with that, I would like to move this item as heard and filed, and roll call, please.
And on that motion that this hearing be heard and filed, Vice Chair Dorsey.
Aye.
Dorsey, aye. Member Engardio. Engardio, aye. Chair Chan.
Aye.
Chan, aye. We have three ayes.
The motion passes. Thank you, Supervisor. Mr. Clerk, please call item number two.
Yes, item number two is an ordinance amending the Business and Tax Regulations Code to authorize the tax collector to waive taxes, penalties, and or interest under a program ending December 31st, 2027 that allows unregistered taxpayers to voluntarily disclose and pay back taxes, and to authorize the tax collector to collect fees through December 31st, 2027 for reviewing applications for and providing advanced determinations to taxpayers. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Actually, could we also call item number three?
Yes, item number three is an ordinance amending the Business and Tax Regulations Code to suspend the empty homes tax pending a final decision in Eric DeBon et al. Versus City and County of San Francisco et al. In San Francisco Superior Court, retroactive to January 1st, 2024, and to reinstate the tax, that tax, so that the tax first applies in the tax year immediately following the calendar year of that final decision. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Let's go one item at a time, but thank you.
Hello again. You guys are going to be sick of me after this morning. Apologies.
Not at all.
Item two is an ordinance that authorizes a voluntary disclosure program for unregistered San Francisco businesses to come forward and address unpaid taxes. This ordinance also authorizes our office to charge a fee for a separate advance determination program that will provide guidance to taxpayers before they file taxes. First, a little bit of context. In November, as you all know, San Francisco voters approved Proposition M, which is a significant restructuring of the city's business tax system. In preparation for the reform, we held a series of interested parties meetings in 2024 to gather feedback from the business community. And we heard loud and clear during those meetings and also during the formulation of Prop M that there's really a need for more clarity and transparency from our office about how taxes are administered. So the two components being presented today are a direct result of taxpayer feedback, and these include a voluntary disclosure agreement program, which we like to call VDA, and an advance written determination fee authorization program. So let's first review the voluntary disclosure agreement program. This ordinance authorizes us to waive taxes, penalties, and interest for businesses that voluntarily come forward to pay unpaid back taxes and interest. It's a chance for unregistered businesses to get these tax obligations in order without facing the full weight of penalties and back taxes. They have to disclose and pay for the previous 6 years. And to qualify for the program, they can't already have a business registration certificate, and they must not have already been contacted by our office. So as we like to say, they have to be completely off of our radar, completely new to us, in order to take advantage of this program. This is a program that exists in nearly every taxing agency around the country. So the state has a similar program, the IRS has a similar program, and we've had one informally for a long time, and what businesses said is it would really help us to have this legislatively authorized, to have the rules clearly spelled out, and to have the timeline, you know, kind of firmly there. So if the board approves this ordinance, we will be ready as soon as this ordinance is effective to take applications for this program. We believe that this program not only improves compliance, but is actually a revenue generator. Our informal program has already demonstrated this. We've generated $2.9 million in back taxes and $1.6 million in ongoing tax revenue through our informal voluntary disclosure program. So based on the success of the informal program that we have now and the certainty that we think this is going to bring and what we've heard from businesses, we do expect to see the following revenue over the next 3 years if the program is authorized: about $1.5 million in prior years and $1 million ongoing. So small but mighty. The second component of this program, of this ordinance, is the authorization of a fee for the new advance written determination program. Prop M included a requirement to establish this program, and we're on schedule to roll it out this spring pending your approval. This program allows taxpayers to request a determination in advance, which is a significant step forward in terms of providing more clarity about somebody's tax liability. And for applications filed on or before December 31st, the fee is $250. And then after December 31st, the fee will be no more than our actual cost of providing the determination. Again, this is something that really came from a lot of conversations with the taxpaying community who feel like in our current state, without a program like this, their only opportunity to get a formal determination from our office is upon audit or in a lawsuit. And so this is our hope is that we can really engage in some more serious conversations and provide these determinations up front so that businesses know where we stand on implementing the law and can make their best decisions moving forward. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. It's interesting. I'm trying to understand. So the business that came forward and that which has resulted in roughly $1 million revenue generating. So are they really like micro, small business, and how what is the size usually that end up coming forward?
Yeah, there's really a range, and that is super fascinating. Often what happens is one business will acquire another business, and in their due diligence, they're like, huh, doesn't look like you've been filing local taxes. And so that's sort of our kind of most common use case is during an acquisition. As you might recall, some years ago, there was a ballot measure that changed the threshold for when a business has to file and pay taxes in San Francisco. And so if a business is doing more than $500,000 in sales into San Francisco, even if they don't have a single employee here, they have no physical nexus with San Francisco, they're still required to file and pay. And so that has also changed the landscape of who became a taxpayer. And so, of course, our team is actively looking for folks who are unregistered, and we have a full program, and we send, you know, everyone's favorite letter from a tax investigator that we think you're an unregistered business and you must register immediately. That happens very regularly. But of course, we miss things, as every tax agency does. And so this is a chance for people to come forward. And typically in other jurisdictions, when they've passed an ordinance like this, there's a bit of a flood of applications. People are kind of waiting, and then we see a lot of activity, and then it kind of normalizes over time.
Interesting. Because basically one of the criteria here that you listed is that you must not be notified, like you must not have gotten a letter to say, hey, right, you need to register in order for you to actually qualify for this program.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. We're ready for the next item.
Okay.
I think we're ready. Okay. Yes, we're ready.
Okay, last one, I promise. Item 3 is an ordinance that suspends the empty homes tax pending the resolution of an ongoing lawsuit that currently prevents the city from collecting the tax. So to provide some background, in 2022, San Francisco voters approved the empty homes tax, which applies to certain residential units, primarily apartments and condos, that remain vacant for more than 6 months in a calendar year. The tax took effect on January 1st, 2024. Shortly after the tax was passed, a lawsuit was filed challenging its constitutionality. And in November of 2024, the San Francisco Superior Court ruled in favor of the plaintiffs and prohibited the city from taking any action to administer or collect the tax. The city is appealing this decision, but the legal process could take years, which would leave both the city and property owners in limbo during this time. We believe this ordinance provides a practical solution to that uncertainty. If the city ultimately prevails on appeal, our office will face enormous administrative challenges in attempting to retroactively collect back taxes from the prior years. One unique challenge of this tax is that it requires property owners to file every year, even if they don't owe the tax. This is similar to the commercial vacancy tax, which I've come and presented on several times, but on a much larger scale, many more taxpayers. So if forced to collect the tax retroactively, our office will encounter some serious obstacles. Property ownership may have changed during that time. Many required records may no longer be available, making it nearly impossible to determine tax liability, and taxpayers may not have documentation to respond to audits or compliance efforts. I know the BLA will be presenting on this item, and so I just want to emphasize that the primary driver of any revenue loss is not the ordinance that you're voting on today, but the court order, which prohibits the city from collecting the tax. It also prohibits the city from communicating with taxpayers about the tax, so we can't use this time to do any education about the tax and make people know about their obligations. Additionally, even without the lawsuit, revenue collections would likely fall below initial projections due to the natural ramp-up period associated with new taxes, which requires significant education, outreach, and compliance efforts. And we've seen that too with the commercial vacancy tax. It takes a lot of effort to help people understand that they have to file a tax even if they don't owe it. And that's really where the bulk of our work is in the first few years of a tax. So whether or not this ordinance passes, we can't take any action to administer, communicate about, or collect the empty homes tax due to the court order. And we believe this ordinance acknowledges that the retroactive collection would be administratively impractical, financially burdensome, and unfair to taxpayers. We believe passing this ordinance would provide clarity and a reasonable path forward, ensuring that if the tax is ultimately upheld, it can be implemented effectively moving forward. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Good morning, Nick Menard from the Budget Legislative Analyst Office. So item 3 is an ordinance that pertains to the empty homes tax. It would amend the business and tax regulations code to essentially push the start date of the tax from January 1st, 2024 until the resolution of the litigation that is challenging the validity of this tax. As we summarize on page 3 of our report, what this means is that if the litigation is resolved in the city's favor, rather than the tax being retroactively due back to January 2024, it would be due in the year following the resolution of that litigation. There is a revenue impact from this ordinance, I believe, because according to the controller's office, the controller estimated that $9 million in revenue would be collected from this tax in 2024, rising up to $15.4 million in later years. There's a lot of uncertainty with that revenue. There's an education campaign that the treasurer tax collector would have to go through. But it does, that is a loss to the city. It is not a general fund revenue. The empty homes tax is a special revenue essentially dedicated to various uses for affordable housing. So there's not a direct impact on the general fund. But this is still, I think, a policy matter for the board to decide.
Thank you. We do want to thank the city attorney's office for their effort in defending the suit and defending the city against the suit. And it's regrettable that we're here with this situation that we are facing, that we have to suspend temporarily until it's resolved. Of course, I wish we are not here, but here we are. And I think that both based on the advice from the city attorney's office and I think treasurer's collector's office indicated that this is this temporary approach in suspending the collection clearly lead to find where the city is makes sense both for the city and for the people that we eventually have to reach out to collect this tax should we prevail in our appeal of the suit. So Vice Chair Dorsey.
Thank you, Chair Chan. So I think I agree with the sentiment that Chair Chan is expressing. It is hard in this role to say no to dollars, but I've also been around this building long enough to see that tax litigation can create some really big uncertainties. And when I first started in the city attorney's office, actually, it was then city attorney Louise Rennie was settling a gross receipts tax case for $80 million that could have been, had that gone to trial, closer to $600 million. So I'm sensitive to some of the uncertainties that litigation may create, even when we think, our city attorney thinks that we may prevail on things. So I'm inclined to support this.
Thank you. And so with that, we'll go to public comments on both items.
Yes, we are now opening public comment for both items 2 and 3, if we have any members of the public joining us today who wish to address this committee. Madam Chair, we have no speakers.
Seeing no public comments, public comment is now closed. And colleagues, I would like to move this forward to full board with recommendation and a roll call, please.
And on that motion, to forward both ordinances to the full board with a positive recommendation, Vice Chair Dorsey. Dorsey, aye. Member Engardio. Engardio, aye. Chair Chan.
Aye.
Chan, aye. We have 3 ayes.
The motion passes. Thank you. And with that, I would like to call items number 4 and 5 together.
Yes, item numbers 4 and 5 are resolutions approving modification number 2 to an airport contract for project management support services for the San Francisco International Airport, both for a new total not to exceed amount of $13 million and extending the contract for services an additional 4 years from May 1st, 2025 for a total term of May 2nd, 2024 through May 1st, 2029, respectively, pursuant to the charter and making findings under the California Environmental Quality Act. Item number four is for Cargo Building 626.1 project with Consor PMCM Inc. to increase the contract amount by $10.3 million. And item number five is for Cargo Building 720.1 and GSE Building 742 project with Westfield Consultants, a joint venture between WSP USA Inc. and AGS Inc. to increase the contract amount by $10 million. Madam Chair.
Thank you. We'll take the items separately in presentation since one of them has BLA report, but please go ahead.
They both have BLA reports.
Oh, my apologies. Thank you.
No problem. Oh, would you like them together or separate?
Let's do separately. Still.
Separately? Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
So the first item before you requests approval of modification number two to an existing project management support service contract with Consor PMCM for the Cargo Building 626.1 project. The first item increases the contract amount by $10.3 million and extends the contract duration for an additional 4 years through May 1st, 2029. The project demolishes existing facilities and constructs a new cargo facility to support the future development of the Westfield area, which will modernize facilities, improve operational facility, and support future cargo demands. The contract results from a 2023 competitive request for qualifications, request for proposals process, and Consor was the top-ranked proposer. The contractor provides overall management expertise and oversight of the project, and services include design and construction management, project controls, contract administration, cost estimating, and field inspections. Contract costs are funded by the Ascent program, and there is a local business enterprise subconsulting participation requirement of 20%. The airport conducted a formal performance evaluation of the contractor in 2024, and the contractor met and exceeded expectations in 25 of 27 measures. The BLA has recommended approval, and we are happy to answer any questions.
Item four is a resolution that approves a contract amendment between the airport and Consor, which is a project management firm that the airport hired to manage a construction project at the airport to demolish a building used for cargo operations and build a new one. We detail the budget of this contract on page 8 of our report. It is rising from $2.7 to $13 million, largely due to the extension of the contract from 1 to 5 years. I think the rates for the service are reasonable. There's no performance issues with this contractor, and this is funded by the airport capital revenues, which are general airport revenues and airport revenue bonds. We recommend approval of item four.
Thank you. Great. We'll go to the item number five.
Okay. This item also requests approval of modification number two to the existing project management support services contract with Westfield Consultants for the Cargo Building 720.1 and Ground Services Equipment, or GSE Building 742 project. This item increases the contract amount by $10 million and extends the contract duration for an additional 4 years through May 1st, 2029. Similar to the other project, it demolishes existing facilities and constructs a new cargo facility and GSE maintenance building to support the future development of the Westfield area. It is also a result from a 2023 competitive RFQ-RFP process, and Westfield Consultants was the second-ranked proposer. The contractor provides overall management expertise and oversight of the project, and services include design and construction management, project controls, contract administration, cost estimating, and field inspections. Similar to the other, contract costs are funded by the Ascent program, and there is also an LBE subconsulting participation requirement of 20%. The airport conducted a formal performance evaluation of the contractor in 2024, and the contractor met and exceeded expectations in 25 of 27 measures. The BLA has recommended approval, and we all are also happy to answer any questions on this item.
Thank you.
Item 5 is a resolution that pertains to, would approve a airport contract with Westfield Consultants. They're a joint venture of WSP and AGS, which are two San Francisco-based engineering firms. This amendment would extend the agreement from 1 to 5 years and increase the contract value from $3 to $13 million. We detailed the budget on page 16 of our report. The rates and overall contract budget are reasonable. There's no performance issues. This contract's also funded by the airport capital plan. We recommend approval of item 5.
Thank you. I appreciate the concern. While it's the only remaining bidder of that process, is that correct? And, but then it's the fact that they honor the local business enterprise agreement to the 20%. I appreciate the airport continue to ensure that, even though I know it's probably posed some challenges with that requirement. And thank you for bringing both items to us today. And I don't see any other name on the roster. We'll go to public comments on these items.
Yes, we're now opening public comment for anyone who wishes to address this committee regarding these items 4 and 5. Now is your opportunity. Madam Chair, we have no speakers.
Seeing no public comments, public comment is now closed. Colleagues, I would like to move both items to full board with recommendation and a roll call, please.
And on that motion, to forward both resolutions to the full board with a positive recommendation. Vice Chair Dorsey.
Aye.
Dorsey, aye. Member Engardio.
Aye.
Engardio, aye. Chair Chan.
Aye.
Chan, aye. We have 3 ayes.
The motion passes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And with that, Mr. Clerk, please call item number 6.
Yes, item number 6. Is a resolution approving and authorizing the General Manager of the Public Utilities Commission to execute Amendment Number 1 to the Radio Communications Site Lease dated April 1st, 2015 between the City and County through the PUC as the tenant and Communication and Control, Inc. as the landlord to allow the PUC to expand the leased premises on a portion of a parcel in unincorporated Alameda County and operate additional radio communication equipment on the tower located on the premises for an initial monthly base rent of approximately $9,000 for the lease of the expanded premises, affirming the Planning Department's determination under the California Environmental Quality Act pursuant to the Administrative Code and authorizing the General Manager of the PUC and or the City's Director of Property to execute documents, make certain modifications, and take certain actions in furtherance of this resolution, and to authorize the PUC, General Manager, and or City Director of Property to enter into any amendments or modifications to the amendment, including without limitation the exhibits that the General Manager determines in consultation with the City Attorney are in the best interest of the City and do not materially increase the obligations nor liabilities of the City and are necessary or advisable to effectuate the purposes and intent of the amendment or this resolution pursuant to the Charter. Madam Chair.
Thank you. And today we have SIPUC here.
Thank you, Chair Chan. Good morning, Supervisors. Josh Keene, Assistant Real Estate Director for the SFPUC. I'll be brief on this one. This is a lease amendment of a previously approved radio communications lease. It was approved by the Board of Supervisors most recently in 2015 after replacing an original lease from 2005. So we have a long-term lease that allows the SFPUC to be there until 2040. This is an amendment of that existing radio communications lease to allow an expansion of the premises so that the SFPUC can install, operate, and maintain additional equipment within the existing equipment shelter and an expansion within the appurtenant tower. So what this equipment does, and it's more timely than ever, obviously, with the tragedy down south in Los Angeles area, the Mount Allison radio communications site is part of the SFPUC's SCADA system, which is critical for the water and the power transmission operations across the San Joaquin Valley. The site also provides voice radio communication capability for the watershed staff, which is especially critical when managing fires, search and rescue coordination, and other emergencies in the watershed. This site in particular is invaluable due to its geographic location, sight lines, and ability to satisfy coverage requirements. All of that is part and parcel to the original approval. Today is an expansion of the ongoing needs here. What this amendment itself is doing is effectively all it's doing is increase in order to accommodate the increased equipment and premises space. it's increasing the existing rent from $5,700 per month to $9,000 per month, so just over $40,000 per year. And this was actually contemplated that from time to time there would be an expansion and we would return to the Board of Supervisors, and that's what we're doing here. One additional modification is the SFPUC will be assuming responsibility for the electrical utilities, but the landlord will be agreeing to pay for all of the gas. And the SFPUC radio communications staff, using data available from the state of California, verified the appropriateness of the increase based upon those equipment rates. So this was approved categorically exempt from CEQA. And allowing this to move forward will allow the SFPUC to procure the equipment that's already been in the budget and to move forward with the installation of the new equipment. I'm happy to answer any questions. I've also got staff from the SFPUC if you have any technical questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, I suddenly have a quick question because I don't see that in the resolution or in the legislation. So with this expansion, does that also mean that it's inclusive of the original lease that we set forth in 2015 all the way to 2040?
That's correct. Okay. So it's effectively amending the premises and the rent as though we did this in 2015.
Understood.
And it was actually contemplated this would happen, and we have authority to do this administratively. But there was a threshold amount that required coming back to the board rather than at our commission level.
Got it.
And so that's where we are.
Sorry. And so this is applicable to all the way to 2040?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Just to note, though, there are options to extend at our choice through 2040. So there are five-year options. So theoretically, if we did not want to renew in 2030, we could exit entirely.
Thank you. Much appreciated. And with that, let's go to public comment on this item.
Yes, members of the public who wish to address this committee regarding this item number 6. Now is your opportunity to approach the lectern. Madam Chair, we have no speakers.
Seeing no public comments, public comment is now closed. Colleagues, I would like to move this item to full board with recommendation and a roll call, please.
And on the motion to forward to the full board, the positive recommendation, Vice Chair Dorsey. Dorsey, aye. Member Engardio. Engardio, aye. Chair Chan.
Aye.
Chan, aye. We have three ayes.
The motion passes. And Mr. Clerk, please call item number 7.
Yes, item number 7 is a resolution approving an emergency declaration of the Public Utilities Commission pursuant to the Administrative Code to contract resources to restore the Tesla Treatment Facility's uninterruptible standby power supply system, which has become obsolete and was found to have failed on December 11, 2024 during routine maintenance with a total estimated cost of $700,000. Madam Chair.
Thank you. And before you start, I just want to be on the record. I was alarmed, therefore I'm going to put it on record. This has nothing to do with the corporation known as Tesla. Simply named, the facility is Tesla, not after the corporation, nor affiliates with the corporation. So please go ahead, and the floor is yours for SF Public Utilities Commission.
Thank you for that clarification up front, Chair Chan. Good morning, Chair Chan, Supervisor Dorsey, and Supervisor Engardio. I'm Angela Chang. I'm the Water Supply and Treatment Division Manager for the SFPUC. So the item before you today seeks your approval of the SFPUC's emergency declaration for the restoration of the Tesla Treatment Facility's uninterruptible standby power control system with an estimated cost of $700,000. Tesla Treatment Facility is located in San Joaquin County. It provides primary disinfection and fluoridation for the Hetch Hetchy supply. On December 11th, the facility's standby power control system was found to have failed. The existing standby power control system is 15 years old, and some components have become obsolete. We're in the process of executing an emergency contract with Holt of California to perform this work by April 30th. Holt is an exclusive dealer of Caterpillar equipment in central Northern California. They're familiar with this facility's electrical equipment, and they have experience performing repair and maintenance services for this system. With this emergency contract, the standby power control system will be replaced with new controllers, Ethernet switches, a new Ethernet communications network, and other processors. The BLA recommends approving this item. I'm available if you have any questions.
Thank you.
Item 7 is a resolution approving an emergency declaration. So this is not approving a contract. It's actually just approving the PUC to suspend contracting rules that are required in the municipal code so that they can contract more swiftly to meet this emergency. The emergency is that the standby power system at the Tesla treatment facility in the East Bay, there are certain components that failed and need to be replaced. So the PUC plans to replace those components, which were made by Caterpillar using an authorized Caterpillar dealer, Holt of California. We detailed the cost of this repair work on page 23 of our report. It's based on a proposal from Holt that was then refined by PUC staff. This will be paid for by an existing maintenance fund for the facility. It's not going to cannibalize the budget of any other projects. So we recommend approval of item 7.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your work. And I don't have any questions. I don't see any name on roster. Let's go to public comment on this item.
Yes, we are now opening public comment for this item number 7. If we have any members of the public wish to address this committee.
So, sorry. Seeing no public comments.
Yes, Madam Chair, we have no speakers.
Sorry. Seeing no public comments, public comment is now closed. I now do actually have a quick question for SFPUC. When is this project is going to expect it to complete?
By April 30th, so in a little less than 2 months.
Thank you. I was searching for that. Yes, April 30th, 2025. Understood. Thank you. And so with that, and I would like to move this item to full board with recommendation and a roll call, please.
Yes, on that motion to forward to the full board with a positive recommendation, Vice Chair Dorsey.
Aye.
Dorsey, aye. Member Engardio.
Aye.
Engardio, aye. Chair Chan.
Aye.
Chan, aye. We have 3 ayes.
The motion passes. With that, Mr. Clerk, please call item 8 and 9 together.
Yes, item numbers 8 and 9. Item number 8 is a resolution approving the Third Amendment to the agreement between the city acting by and through the health service system and Highland Software, Inc. for software that facilitates capture, organization, and storage of HSS member documents to extend the term by 5 years from April 1st, 2025 for a total term of January 4th, 2016. Through March 31st, 2030, and to increase the amount by approximately $192,000 for a total not to exceed an amount of $574,000, and to authorize the executive director of HSS to enter into amendments or modifications to the contract amendment that do not materially increase the obligations nor liabilities to the city and are necessary to effectuate the purposes of the contract amendment or the resolution. And item number 9 is a resolution approving the 10th amendment to an agreement between the city and PNA Administrative Services, Inc. to administer COBRA AB 528 programs, healthcare spending accounts, and flexible spending accounts to extend the term by 18 months for a total term of approximately 12 years from March 1st, 2015 through December 31st, 2026, and to increase the amount by $555,000 for a total not to exceed amount of approximately $4.6 million, and to make the same authorizations. Madam Chair.
Thank you. And today we have Health Service System here.
Michael Visconti, Contracts Administration Manager for the San Francisco Health Service System. Our first item today is a request for a resolution to extend the agreement we have with Highland. Highland Software provides a customized sole source software solution for SFHSS. We have been in a partnership with Highland for almost 10 years now. It began as a sole source software agreement, and this is an integral part of what we do at SFHSS, though a very small dollar value in comparison to our other agreements. It allows us to move away from tactile files and keeping files on premises, and allows us to integrate our records in with the city's human resource information system, or PeopleSoft. This has allowed us to maintain safely and securely and access quickly for members over 300,000 records, and also repurpose much of our floor plan at 1145 Market Street to have rooms dedicated to meeting with members rather than storing paper files. The request will be to extend this agreement for 5 years, and the total amount for that five-year period not to exceed $574,000.
Thank you. Please go ahead to item number 9.
Absolutely. My second item for today is a request to extend our current agreement with P&A Administrative Services, Inc. for the administration of our COBRA, AB 528, and flexible spending accounts for 18 months to allow SFHSS to conduct a competitive bid for these services for calendar year or plan year 2027. The scope will remain unchanged as it has been with this partner who we've had since 2015. The 18-month extension and the increase in value will be $555,000 to a total not to exceed value of the agreement of $4,667,457. This is an integral part of what HSS does in the administration of benefits and adherence to IRS rules when it comes to COBRA, or the Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1986. This allows the continuation of medical, dental, vision, and FSA coverage following a qualifying event and requires notice of eligibility and benefits. Our partners at P&A provide these notifications to every new employee about their rights under COBRA, and they also provide them notices if a qualifying event has occurred. AB 528, or California Assembly Bill from 1985, allows for the continuation of health or dental upon retirement, and this is for California schools in the Community College District. SFHSS administers AB 528 for the Community College District and the San Francisco Unified School District for medical coverage only. Healthcare FSAs allow employees to use pre-tax dollars for qualifying expenses. They may do this through an FSA debit card, submitting receipts through an online portal, through their smartphone, or through the mail. This is a very popular benefit with our employees and has increased every year with the exception of the first full year of COVID, but very quickly returned to its pre-pandemic levels. We also have a dependent care assistance FSA, which allows employees to use pre-tax dollars to pay for certified daycare, preschool, or elder care. And as summarized in the BLA report, the FSA enrollment between 2016 and 2025 has increased from 4,279 individuals to 8,920 as of this last year. We've also seen a 3-time increase in the total amount of pre-tax healthcare FSA dollars being set aside by employees. And our dependent care assistance FSA enrollment has also increased during this time from 1,256 to 1,651. In addition to the maintenance of our FSA requirements, P&A also issued 5,088 initial COBRA notices for new hires in 2024 and 4,680 qualifying event notices. These, of course, fluctuate each year depending on the rates of hiring and the incidence of qualifying events. This contract has 9 amendments to date. Amendments 1 through 4 occurred prior to 2020. These extended the agreement, and they also increased the not-to-exceed amount to cover the services. Amendment number 5 occurred in 2020. This was a decision by the San Francisco Health Service System to amend the contract so as not to have any disruption to continuing medical, dental, and vision coverage for employees during the COVID-19 pandemic. Another factor in our decision to amend this agreement in 2020 was our ability to negotiate 0 increase in all service charges with this vendor since its initiation, and that has continued with each amendment since that time. Most importantly, it allowed us to prioritize the following benefit plan competitive procurements. The first being the 2020 Health Plan RFP, the second, the Medicare RFI and RFP in 2021 and 2023 and 24, and the current life and disability benefits RFP for plan year 2026. HSS has a very unique rates and benefits calendar and cycle. To conduct RFPs for our benefits, we have to follow this, and we would follow this if this resolution is approved, allowing us to use the most up-to-date information for a competitive bid to get the most accurate and qualified responses. We present to the board each summer on our recommendations for health service board approved benefits. We usually release our RFPs in December. We try to conclude them within the rates and benefits cycle, typically by March or April of the following year. This is particularly important for this scope of services, where we would have contracting and implementation between April and September, allowing us to be ready for open enrollment for plan year 2027 in October 2026, and transition those flexible spending account dollars as of January 1st, 2027. As stated in the BLA's report, they have recommended for this item that we conduct an internal audit to determine if we have any other agreements that would exceed the requirements of the charter. And we have determined that only the first item, item number 8, which is the Highland agreement, and this are approaching the 10-year or $10 million or an increase of $500,000. The other agreements have all been approved by the Board of Supervisors. Most recently, in June 30th, 2024, Ordinance 216-24. And this would be for the agreements for our health, dental, and vision benefits, which all exceed those thresholds. With that, I'm available to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Item 9 is a resolution that approves a contract amendment between the health service system and PNA Administrative Services. PNA basically administers the COBRA and FSA benefits for this city. This contract was awarded following a competitive process that concluded in 2015, and the contract began March 2015. It's been amended several times to extend the agreement. The current end date is June 2025. And so what this amendment does essentially is just extend the existing agreement from June 2025 to December 2026, and then adds $550,000 to the contract value to basically carry them through the next 18 months. Those costs are funded by the general fund, and we detail the budget for and spending on the contract on page 30 of our report. There's no, I think, performance issues with this vendor. I think the rates are reasonable. There is, I think, the current version of the contract, which was amended in December 2024 to extend the agreement through June 2025, that was the time that the contract exceeded 10 years because it began in March 2015. That really should have come to the board back in December. They're here now. I think because some of the services started in June 2015, so I think there was the clock started for them at that time rather than in March when the kind of overall contract began. It was for that reason that we asked the department to go back and just check the other contracts to see if any others were approaching the 9118 thresholds. It sounds like there are no other contracts that need board approval, so we recommend item 9 for approval.
Thank you. Vice Chair Dorsey.
Great. I just am, as the sponsor of this, I just wanted to say that I am in support of this, but I did appreciate the BLA's catching that, and I just wanted to clarify that I heard that you've already complied with the recommendation that you check everything and we're good on everything. Okay.
That's correct. Thank you, Dorsey. Thank you.
Thank you. And just appreciate all the work that that everyone is doing at a health services system. Particularly, just want to give a quick shout out to Director Abby Yens. Thank you so much for your service. Please don't ever retire, but I know it's hard to convince you to do that otherwise. So thank you. So with that, we'll go to public comments on these two items.
Thank you, Supervisors.
Yes, if we have any members of the public who wish to address this committee regarding these items 8 or 9, now is your opportunity. Madam Chair, we have no speakers.
Seeing no public comments, public comment is now closed. What is your will, Vice Chair Dorsey?
Could we forward this? I'd like to make a motion to forward both of these items to the full board with a positive recommendation.
Great. A roll call, please.
And on that motion by Vice Chair Dorsey that we forward both resolutions to the full board with a positive recommendation. Vice Chair Dorsey.
Aye.
Dorsey, aye. Member Engardio. Engardio, aye. Chair Chan.
Aye.
Chan, aye. We have 3 ayes.
The motion passes. Mr. Clerk, please call item 10 and 11 together.
Yes, item numbers 10 and 11 are resolutions approving and authorizing the director of property to enter into real property leases of the Village Community Facility located at 1099 Sunnydale Avenue with the following, both for an initial term of 5 years with 2 5-year options to extend, effective upon approval of the respective resolutions, and making findings that competitive bidding procedures required under the Administrative Code are impractical or impossible, that the respective leases furthers a proper public purpose sufficient to meet Administrative Code market value requirements, and authorizing the director of property to enter into any additions, amendments, or other modifications to the respective leases that do not materially increase the obligations nor liabilities to the city to effectuate the purposes of their resolutions. Item 10 is with Family and Child Empowerment Services, or FACES SF, for approximately 3,000 square feet of the facility at an initial rent of approximately $49,000 per year with 3% annual increases thereafter. The initial rent includes approximately 822 square feet of office space in support of a temporary grant and programming collaboration with Family Connection Centers, providing services to the community. Should future grants for said collaboration not be funded after the first year of the lease or any subsequent year thereafter, during the initial 5-year term, whereby the new adjusted rent will be approximately $3,000 per month or approximately $36,000 per year with a 3% annual increase. And item number 11 is with Felton Institute for approximately 1,500 square feet of the facility and for an initial term of 5 years with 2 5-year options to extend at an initial rent of approximately $24,000 per year with 3% annual increases thereafter. Madam Chair.
Thank you. And today we have Rio Este here.
Good morning, Chair Chan, Supervisor Dorsey, Supervisor Engardio, and Draco Pennick, Director of Real Estate. I'm before you this morning with 2 leases, both at 1099 Sunnydale Avenue, also known as the Villages. Starting with the FACES SF lease. As you may know, 1099 Sunnydale Avenue, also known as the Villages, is a neighborhood community facility under the jurisdiction of the Real Estate Division, or RED, located in and serving the Visitation Valley neighborhood. The facility offers office space, a range of shared meeting rooms, and a large ground floor community room for program-related events and community meetings. In its mission to invest in the housing and community development in the Visitation Valley, the United States Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, in collaboration with the city and other nonprofits, completed construction of this approximately 15,000 square foot, 3-story building in 2004. FACES SF is committed to providing services to meeting the diverse need of children, youth, and families within the Visitation Valley community and across San Francisco. Since 2013, FACES SF has provided workforce development services, recruitment and hiring events, job readiness training, parent and family workshops, and case management services at this location. FACES SF receives supporting grants through the city's Office of Economic and Workforce Development. The term of the lease before you is for 5 years with 2 5-year options to extend. The initial rent is a little bit more than $4,000 per month or $48,000 per year annually. The rent increases at 3% and the premises encompasses approximately 3,000 square feet. As mentioned by the clerk in the introduction, one portion of the premises, approximately 800 square feet, is basically being leased on a month-to-month, a year-to-year basis. This is to match up with the temporary grant that is being received by Family Connection Center. As long as Family Connection Center receives the grant, Faces SF will continue to lease the 800 square feet of space. However, should the grant cease, the lease allows for Faces SF to release this 800 square feet, which would no longer be needed. The year-to-year basis is contingent upon providing 90 days notice to the city of continued use and need for the space. As also mentioned previously, the rent would adjust down to a little less than 3,000 square feet per month, $3,000 per month, or $35,000 per year. Should the 800 square feet no longer be needed, the rent would still increase at 3%, and the adjusted square footage would reduce from the 3,000 square feet to approximately 2,200 square feet. We have the Chief Operating Officer and Workforce Development Officer from Faces SF in the gallery. They and I are available to take any questions you may have. Moving on to the next presentation.
Yep, please, thank you.
This lease is also at 1099 Sunnydale Avenue for Felton Institute. It is also, again, a five-year lease. I won't repeat the background of the villages, which you've just heard. Felton Institute was founded in 1889, formerly known as Family Services Agency, and is committed to providing social services and resources to meet the diverse need of children, youth, and families within the Visitation Valley community and across San Francisco. Felton Institute has provided programs such as employment training and job placement, basic computer training and tech support, exercise classes, community bingo, and the like. Felton Institute receives support grants and contracts through the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development, and also the Digital Literacy Training Program, and also from the Human Services Agency, or HSA. The term of this lease is also 5 years, with 2 5-year options to extend. The rent is slightly more than $2,000 per month, or $24,000 per year. It increases at 3%, and the premises here consist of approximately 1,500 square feet. No tenant improvements are necessary for this continuing lease. I have the Aging Services Director from Felton Institute in the chambers. She and I are also available to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Just want to thank everyone for your work. It's a critical space for our community to be able to have childcare, job training, both for Faces and Felton Institute. So much for your partnership with the city, providing that services for our constituents in Sunnydale. So with that, happy to go to public comments. I don't see any name on the rosters. I don't have any further questions. Let's go to public comments on both items.
Yes, we are now opening public comment for these items 10 and 11. If we have any members of the public who wish to address this committee. Madam Chair, we have no speakers.
Seeing no public comments, public comment is now closed. Colleagues, I would like to send these items both with recommendation to full board and a roll call, please.
And on the motion to forward both resolutions to the full board to the positive recommendation. Vice Chair Dorsey.
Aye.
Dorsey, aye. Member Engardio.
Aye.
Engardio, aye. Chair Chan.
Aye.
Chan, aye. We have three ayes.
The motion passes. And with that, Mr. Clerk, do we have any other business before us today?
Madam Chair, that concludes our business.
Thank you, and we will return today as for our first Budget and Appropriation Committee hearing starting at 1:30.
Chair Chan?
Oh.
If I may?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to take a brief moment of your time to introduce my new Deputy Director of Real Estate, Lisa Giovanelli. She's replacing Claudia Gorham, who recently retired.
Oh. Congratulations. Welcome on board. We look forward to seeing you in this chamber.
Absolutely. Look forward to working with you. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. I was in 1:30 today, and it's our Budget and Appropriation Committee. It's the first one, and we'll have just one item on the agenda hearing. So we'll see you. We'll return then. And no other business before us?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and the meeting's adjourned.